From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Michael Clare applauds President Bush's nuclear arms reductions. Nevertheless, he doesn't think it's a sign of America's commitment to disarmament. He sees the plan as a sign of America's shift to a new military posture for the post-Cold War era. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss this new military posture with professor and journalist Michael Clare. Also, journalist Robert Cullen returns to tell us about his latest trip to Russia, interviewing men in the military about their roles in the coup. TV critic David Bianculli reviews specials about Columbus's voyage and the war in the Gulf. And John Leonard reviews Norman Mailer's new novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Brian Naylor. A breakthrough has been reached in the Yugoslav crisis. Serbian and Croatian leaders have agreed that individual republics can secede from the country. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
The breakthrough came at a meeting in The Hague, where the presidents of Serbia and Croatia, the Yugoslav defense minister, and European community negotiators met for 2 hours. All parties agreed that any of Yugoslavia's 6 republics could secede, provided guarantees for the rights of ethnic minorities were given. The question of the Serbian minority in Croatia has been at the heart of the fighting in Yugoslavia since Croatia declared its independence last June. After the meeting, the Yugoslav Federal Army said it would halt all military operations against Croatia. In exchange, Croatia agreed to lift its blockade of Federal Army barracks on its territory. It's the 7th ceasefire since the conflict began. Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic said he was optimistic that this time the hostilities would cease. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman David Boren came to praise CIA Director-designate Robert Gates today after 3 weeks of contentious confirmation hearings. Boren said there was no single person in the intelligence community who tried harder to level with Congress about the Iran-Contra affair and other CIA activities than Gates. President Bush also spoke out on behalf of his nominee, telling reporters he totally dismissed what he called the outrageous assertion that Gates had slanted intelligence findings for political reasons. The committee is expected to vote October 18th on the nomination. 38 nations agreed today to strengthen their joint mechanism for protecting human rights. Agreement came at the conclusion of a month-long conference in Moscow convened by the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, or CSCE. NPR's John Itzde reports from Moscow.
The European nations, plus the United States and Canada, agreed to strengthen their commitment to human rights by allowing the CSCE to investigate suspected human rights violations in a country without that country's consent. That eliminates a long-held CSCE principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of a member country. The head of the U.S. delegation, Ambassador Max Kampelman, said he hoped the new mechanism might, in the future, help prevent the kind of bloodshed and violations of human rights now occurring in Yugoslavia. But the new provisions were criticized as too weak by officials from several countries. Germany had proposed that the CSCE be given the power to place sanctions on countries that violated human rights. The Soviet delegation supported that position, but the U.S. opposed it, saying the idea required further discussion. I'm John Itzde in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 23 points to close at 2961.54. This is NPR News. The unemployment rate eased slightly last month to 6.7% from 6.8% in August. President Bush called the lower jobless rate encouraging and said the economy was improving, but he cautioned that all is not well and said he was, quote, deeply concerned about those who are out of work. The Labor Department said the nation gained only 24,000 jobs outside the farm sector last month, a sign that businesses are still wary about hiring new workers because of the shaky state of the economy. Workers at 2 General Motors brake plants in Dayton, Ohio, are on strike, but negotiations to end the walkout are continuing. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
About 3,300 members of United Auto Workers Local 696 walked off the job this morning and set up picket lines. Union President Joe Hazenjager says the workers started the strike after negotiations failed to reach agreement on two main issues involving work speed-ups and subcontracting. The union contends the company is violating provisions of a three-year contract that was approved earlier this year. Hazenjager says the workers will stay in a strike position until an agreement is reached. GM spokeswoman Sheila Main says the company is disappointed that there's been a strike. The two plants supply brake systems to other GM facilities across the country, and a long strike could end up affecting production nationwide. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan reporting.
The United States and more than two dozen other nations signed an accord today banning mining and oil exploration on Antarctica for the next 50 years. The chairman of the meeting of the Antarctic Treaty Conference said the prohibition will be virtually impossible to reverse after that. The accord bans any activity relating to mineral resources except for scientific research. I'm Brian Naylor, National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush has been widely praised for his plan to reduce our nuclear arsenal. The plan is to eliminate about 2,400 short-range nuclear weapons on land and sea in Europe and Asia. Long-range bombers and some long-range missiles have been taken off 24-hour alert. The president's plan is considered a breakthrough in arms control because it was done independent of any negotiations with the Soviet Union. My guest Michael Clare applauds the president. But Clare says scaling back nuclear weapons aimed at the Soviet Union doesn't mean the American military plans on scaling back its weaponry for fighting wars in other parts of the world. Clare is an associate professor at Hampshire College and directs the Five College Program in Peace and World Securities. He's also the defense correspondent for The Nation. Michael Clare told me he doesn't think the president's plan is exactly about the search for peace.
I do think, however, that it's about the search for stability and security in a very turbulent world and a way of protecting ourselves against possible accidental or unintended nuclear conflicts for which we have no defenses. So there's a security consciousness, but not, I think, an active search for peace.
What do you think the president's motivations were in the arms reduction plan?
I think there are several motivations. One, of course, is presidential politics, and maybe you'd like to talk about that. But from a military point of view, I would say the principal motivation is to deal with a very serious emerging problem that we're facing. And that is, with the breakup of the Soviet Union into its constituent republics, there's a real fear that the very large arsenal of Soviet tactical nuclear weapons, of which there are 10 or 12,000 of them scattered across the Soviet Union and at sea, will fall into hands that are not at the control of Moscow or not under centralized control and can be used for all kinds of nefarious or unpredictable purposes in local wars between the republics or in regional conflicts in Eastern Europe. There are many nightmare scenarios one could think of when you recognize that these tactical nuclear warheads are scattered and not at this point under safe control. And I think that what primarily motivated the president was to find a shortcut to get those weapons under control.
The weapons that will be cut back are largely tactical as opposed to strategic nuclear weapons. What's the difference?
Primarily here, it's what we're aiming the weapons at. Strategic nuclear weapons are weapons aimed at the homeland of the other superpower. Our ICBMs and bombers aimed at the Soviet Union and Soviet equivalent weapons. Tactical nuclear weapons, on the other hand, are weapons aimed at the other country's military forces in the field, large tank armies in Europe, aircraft carriers and naval warships at sea, submarines, aircraft, that sort of thing. It would be easy to think that there are also much smaller weapons, but that's not always the case. Some of these tactical nuclear weapons, so-called, are more powerful in their destructive impact than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki weapons. And that's why it's so worrisome to Washington that these weapons and the Soviet stockpile are not now under assured control. And the fear is, I think, that down the road with the breakup of the Soviet Union, with the possible disappearance from the scene of Mr. Gorbachev, that these things will fall out of centralized control and be used in unpredictable ways.
So the president is hoping that by him cutting back tactical weapons, that the Soviets will do that too. What signs do we have so far? Are the Soviets likely to reciprocate?
I think that probably the president has had some prior conversations with Mr. Gorbachev, or perhaps Secretary Baker did when he was meeting with Gorbachev. Possibly they have some assurances that that will be the case. But I think that it was necessary for the United States to act first, and that's the bold aspect of the president's plan. Up until now, we've always maintained that any arms reductions with the Soviets had to be the result of long-term arms control negotiations with reciprocal agreements and verification and compliance and inspections and so on. And I think the calculation in Washington is that if we followed that route this time around, it would be too late. It would take 5 years or 10 years to have that kind of agreement. And by that time, these weapons could be scattered all across the earth. So I think that the president concluded that the only way to get Gorbachev to act quickly is if we first announced our decision to get rid of these weapons and therefore make it easier for Mr. Gorbachev to make a similar move on his own without looking like he's giving in to the West or, you know, somehow abandoning Soviet defenses. So in that sense, I think this was a very bold move on the part of President Bush.
Do you think that we're compromising our security by getting rid of these weapons?
In no way. I would argue, and I think many security analysts would argue likewise, that these weapons, in fact, were dangerous to our security. You have to understand that they represented a stepping stone between conventional war, large-scale conventional wars like we might see in Europe, and all-out strategic nuclear war between the superpowers. These are the weapons that would be the nuclear weapons that would be used first in battle, and therefore they're very close to the front of the battlefield. They're at ships at sea. They're at risk, and they're very easy to conceive of them being used in haste or in panic quickly, and therefore igniting a global nuclear war that nobody wanted. So I think by getting rid of them, we're actually making ourselves a lot safer than we would be otherwise.
Does the president's arms reduction plan indicate a shift in the American military posture?
I do believe that the president's plan represents the result of rethinking about America's security policy. You might put it this way. Up until now, we've been preparing for World War III, a global all-out war with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. That's no longer a credible scenario. No one believes that that kind of war will occur. And I think that the people in the Pentagon, the senior officers in the Department of Defense and the White House are beginning to think about the wars of the future. World War IV, if you will, with the future threats to America's global power. And I think what they're saying is we need to get rid of this obsolete, unnecessary weaponry of World War III in order to persuade Congress and the American public to finance the buildup for the wars of the future, for this hypothetical World War IV. And I think that underlies, to a great extent, the president's plan, even if it's not explicitly in his speech.
So finally, you think this isn't about disarmament, but about a change in arms?
Exactly. This is about rearming the United States for future wars. It's to clear the ground, clear the air, so that the president can come before Congress and ask for funds for whole new types of weapons and new generations of weapons so that we could be prepared for wars in the 21st century. And he's planning to ask for very large sums of money for these new kinds of weapons.
What do you think the military strategists are conceiving of as a possible scenario for World War IV? And that's how you describe it, as World War IV.
Well, I think that what the military is thinking about for the 21st century is for the emergence of new regional powers equipped with nuclear weapons and ICBMs and large modern conventional forces. And I don't think one could pick a particular country, but I think that one could speculate about the emergence of China or India or Brazil or Argentina in 25 or 30 years equipped with very large arsenals of these weapons. That certainly was what was behind the conflict in the Persian Gulf, the fear that Iraq could be a major military power in the 21st century if we didn't take care of that now. And I think it's this thinking, preparing for conflict with the emerging superpowers of the 21st century, that the new military strategy is aimed at.
This kind of war that you're thinking of as the possible 21st century war, this is what would be called a middle intensity conflict, yes?
Middle intensity if it's confined to one region, in the sense that we would be in combat with a regional power like Iraq, like Syria, like Brazil, rather than on a global scale, which would be a high-intensity conflict like that with the Soviet Union. But it is this sort of middle-range type of war that the Pentagon is focusing on right now, both in its military planning and its weapons development.
Whereas in the 70s and 80s, I guess we were more geared for either an all-out World War III or for a low-intensity conflict.
Exactly. I think in the 1970s and 80s, we were looking at both the high end of the military spectrum, all-out war with the USSR, and the low end, guerrilla wars, insurgencies, proxy wars in Central America, that sort of thing. Now the focus is on the mid-range of conflicts with emerging regional powers that might have some nuclear chemical weapons and some ballistic missiles, but are not as powerful as the Soviet Union was at its peak.
So what kind of weapons do you think are the weapons that American military strategists are thinking of for this kind of mid-range, middle-intensity war?
A combination of things. They certainly need long-range power projection forces, that is, forces that allow the U.S. to project power great distances without the use of intermediate bases. That would include things like aircraft carriers, submarines, amphibious assault ships, the new C-17 intercontinental transport plane, the B-2 bomber, which could fly intercontinental distances, weapons that could be based in the United States and carry a very potent military power to greatly distant locations. That's part of it. The other part, of course, is the high-tech weaponry that would allow inferior numbers of American forces to prevail against much larger numbers of indigenous forces in these areas that we might go to war. So it's a combination of projection forces and high-tech conventional weapons.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Clare. He's an associate professor at Hampshire College, where he directs the five-college program in Peace and World Security Studies. He's also the author of The American Arms Supermarket and co-editor of Low-Intensity Warfare. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Clare is my guest. He's the defense correspondent for The Nation. The president has called for weapons reduction in Eastern Europe, but there hasn't been any call for a cutback in the proposed strategic defense initiative, Star Wars. Would Star Wars fit into this scenario for, you know, the 21st century war?
Very much so, although I think the White House exaggerates the threat. Part of what they're responding to here is the fact that a number of third world countries, including Israel and India and Pakistan, Brazil and Argentina, have begun development of intermediate range and even long range ballistic missiles that would theoretically allow them in the 21st century to fire primitive chemical weapons or primitive nuclear weapons, I should say, and possibly chemical weapons at the United States. And that would be the greatest fear that we might have to face from these mid-intensity wars, these regional conflicts. So Star Wars, in its emerging form, its scaled-back form, would give the United States an absolute insurance policy against that kind of risk. Now, I don't think that that risk is very great, and most other analysts feel the same way. But clearly, the president feels that investing huge amounts of money in these kind of defenses would be to our advantage.
Where do nuclear weapons fit in to the new military strategy?
I think, again, it's as an insurance policy to make sure that no other country will ever arise again that could be militarily superior to the United States, that we would always have one ace in the hand that no one else could duplicate, so that we would always be the number one global power, whether the challenge comes from the Third World or from a rearmed Germany or Japan. This would be the ultimate weapon that we'd have at our disposal to threaten and to intimidate any future rivals. But I don't think they're viewed as actual weapons of war, because there'd be no purpose to that.
Do you think that the military strategists are thinking now about what America's military role should be in the world, since the United States is perhaps the only superpower now?
Yes, I think there's a lot of thought being given to America's future military role. In fact, that's the main activity in the Pentagon today, because there's anxiety that the American public now wants to see a genuine peace dividend, a real scaling back of the military so that funds could be used for other purposes. And so the main preoccupation of American strategists today is to find a credible, viable role for the military in the future. And they are generating a variety of scenarios and contingencies, as they call them, that would justify a large military. One of them, obviously, is a new Saddam Hussein, a new regional power-hungry dictator somewhere in the Third World who would threaten American interests in some form. And we will undoubtedly continue to maintain a very large military force that could be used for that purpose, at least if the Pentagon has its way. But they're thinking of other contingencies as well, of future upheavals in other parts of the Third World, of the sort we saw in Vietnam and in other Third World countries in the past. They're worried about drug conflicts or narco-terrorists, as they're called, engaging in large-scale violence. And I think they're conceivably thinking about the emergence of new superpowers in the 21st century, based in Europe, perhaps, or a rearmed Japan or a rearmed China. These are the sorts of things that Pentagon planners spend a lot of time hypothesizing about and building forces to protect against.
With the Cold War over, do you feel that we are much further away now from nuclear war in this world?
I wish I could say that, but I don't believe it's so. I think we're much further away from the nuclear holocaust of the worst doomsday scenarios of the 1960s and 70s and 80s, when we thought of the end of the Earth, that all living things would perish in a global nuclear conflagration. I think we're far away from that kind of a nuclear war. But I think the risk of a regional nuclear war fought by regional powers armed with primitive nuclear weapons is increasing because of nuclear proliferation and the breakup of the Soviet Union. I'm thinking of a war between Israel and a nuclear-armed Arab country down the road, or a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, both of which now have significant nuclear weapons capabilities, or a future war between Argentina and Brazil fought with nuclear weapons. That kind of conflict, I think the threat of that is increasing as we look into the future. And it's very troubling that that's the case.
Michael Clare is an associate professor at Hampshire College and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Securities. He's also the defense correspondent for The Nation. Norman Mailer has a massive new novel about the CIA called Harlot's Ghost. We're anxious to hear what our book critic John Leonard has to say about it.
In 1976, in New York Magazine, Norman Mailer sneezed metaphors all over Watergate and the CIA. Is America governed by accident more than we are ready to suppose, or by design, he asked. Trying to understand whether our real history is public or secret, exposed, or at the highest level, underground, is equal to exploring the opposite theaters of our cynicism and our paranoia. What a crazy country we inhabit, he cried. What a harlot. What a brute. She squashes sausage out of the minds of novelists on their hot-footed way to a real good plot. Harlot's Ghost is the elephantiasis of that magazine article. A lot of sausage. I'm about to fall on my sword attempting to describe it. We've waited as long for Mailer's CIA novel as we waited for his Egyptian novel. And his sausage is nourishing enough, as far as it goes. It just doesn't go far enough. Flashing back from 1984, the novel never flashes forward again after 1963. We turn these many pages happily. Suppose that Julian Sorrell had joined the CIA instead of the Roman Catholic Church. Suppose C.P. Snow had written Strangers and Brothers about spooks instead of scientists. There is wonderful stuff about Berlin in the 1950s and the Bay of Pigs. And then the kissing stops. Before Vietnam, before Watergate, before Iran and Nicaragua. To be continued, we are told, after 1,300 pages. Our hero, Harry Hubbard, is holed up in Moscow with the manuscript we've just finished reading, and he's looking for Harlot, who may be the company's ultimate mole. And we don't even know if this mole's alive, nor whether he's really a mole, nor why Harry's wife betrayed him with another CIA tough guy, nor even if, as Harry's father suggests, poor Marilyn Monroe was really murdered by Jimmy Hoffa to put the fix on Bobby Kennedy. We don't know because 20 years are left out of the novel. This won't do. I'll follow Mailer into the minds of William Harvey, E. Howard Hunt, Sam Giancana, and Judith Exner. I'll accept Harlot as a version of James Jesus Angleton, the counter-espionage paranoid who saw doubles wherever he looked in his wilderness of mirrors. I'll grant that how we behave in history says something about how we behave in bed, that we're all spooks, that there are ghosts in the nation's attic and between our sheets. Though it does seem to me that Harry, or is it Norman, really wants to go to bed with John Kennedy and Fidel Castro. Being a good sport, I'll even suspend my disbelief when Harlot tells us that communism is the entropy of Christ. And when the wasp ice queen Kittredge trashes Freud and blathers on about her pop Jungian psychology of alpha and omega. The company code names, from glaucoma to Rapunzel to Stonehenge, are very funny. Nor is it Mailer's fault that Don DeLillo, Joan Didion, and Stan Lee in Dunn's Conundrum have already covered a lot of this territory. And it's too late now to get into an argument with Mailer about manhood and heroism and the thrill of the kill. He's always climbed his rocks, so I don't have to. He's braver than I am. Let him make a cult of it. But after so much brilliant tease, you have to deliver, and Harlot's Ghost doesn't. Instead, it evaporates into the foggy notion that evolution is God's cover story, that the whole universe is disinformation. To be continued. I've waited as long for Mailer as I've waited for the Red Sox.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Norman Mailer's new novel, Harlot's Ghost. I'll talk with Norman Mailer next week on the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Robert Cullen was writing a piece on the Soviet military when the coup made his story out of date. So he went right back to Russia and spoke to his sources about their roles in the coup. Coming up, Cullen tells us stories of how the military both supported and resisted the attempt to overthrow Gorbachev. And this weekend, TV is looking at two events in America's history. TV critic David Bianculli has reviews of the PBS series Columbus and the Age of Discovery and ABC's Heroes of the Persian Gulf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. Robert Gates, President Bush's nominee to head the CIA, concluded his testimony today saying he's the best man to end any perception at the agency of slanted intelligence. Gates spent 2 days defending himself against charges that he tailored reports to suit administration policy. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Senate Intelligence Committee wound up its public hearings today on whether to confirm Robert Gates. The hearing started out with a focus on how much Gates knew about the Iran-Contra affair and ended with his defense of allegations that in the past he slanted estimates to suit the views of then-CIA Director William Casey. Today, Gates expressed anger at the suggestion that his failure to recollect certain events should be viewed as suspicious.
I'm a little annoyed at this notion of selective memory or selective amnesia, to take the other side of it. And the fact of the matter is that I don't think it is unreasonable that somebody is not going to remember the details of a conversation that took place 5 or 6 years ago or even 5 or 6 weeks ago.
While the majority of the committee still supports Gates' confirmation, several Democrats have voiced opposition. The committee will vote in 2 weeks. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Iraq was testing missiles as part of a sophisticated nuclear weapons program and was 12 to 18 months away from regular production of weapons. So say members of a United Nations inspection team that returned recently from Baghdad. The program violates the terms of a UN resolution that ended the Persian Gulf War. A 6-alarm fire at the John F. Kennedy Federal Building in downtown Boston broke out shortly after 4 p.m. Eastern Time today and is now under control. The blaze was preceded by a series of explosions that apparently started in a wooden structure on the roof of the skyscraper. 4 minor injuries were reported. Damage has been put at $1 million. David Wright of member station WBUR has more.
The John F. Kennedy Federal Building in the Government Center section of downtown Boston houses the offices of several Massachusetts congressmen and many of the region's government agencies. Fire erupted from the tower's 26th story and roof just after 4 o'clock today. Some workers said they were initially told by an audio tape on an internal public address system to remain where they were, but they soon heard crackling explosions, and when fire officials ordered them to evacuate shortly thereafter, people were seen running from the building. Meanwhile, the flame soared up to 30 feet in the air, and the smoke could be seen for miles. Also, burning debris swirled down to the street below. Police report that people were not above the 15th story of the tower today because of an asbestos removal project on higher floors. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed lower, with the Dow Jones Industrial losing 23 points to close at 2961.54. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News. President Bush held a news conference today in which he announced and trumpeted a 0.1% dip in the unemployment rate. That, he declared, is one more sign that the economy is strengthening. And the president used that decline as another reason to veto a bill that would extend unemployment benefits. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The president insisted that the economy is recovering and therefore the Democratic-supported $6 billion unemployment benefits bill is unnecessary. He is expected to veto the bill next week. Mr. Bush predicted he would sign a more modest bill backed by Republicans. Near the end of his news conference, the president abruptly switched gears to defend his domestic agenda.
A president has to deal with these things. You can have every congressman and every group can deal much more openly and be much more engaged on the domestic side. But on foreign policy, there's a disproportionate responsibility on the president for national security, whatever it is.
The president also defended his embattled nominee to head the CIA, Robert Gates, saying he was sure Gates would never distort intelligence data for political purposes. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Haiti's deposed president said today he'll wait to see whether diplomacy turns aside the coup that toppled him before considering the use of force. President Jean-Bertrand Aristide told reporters in Washington that neither he nor President Bush have chosen to send troops to Haiti. President Bush has separately said that he would be reluctant to use U.S. military force to counter the military coup unless the lives of U.S. citizens are threatened. Today, a mission by the Organization of American States left for Haiti in an effort to convince the coup leaders that they'd made a mistake in overthrowing Aristide. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower with the Dow Jones Industrial Average losing 23 points to close at 2961.54. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When there's big news in the Soviet Union, we often ask journalist Robert Cullen to interpret it for us. And each time he's joined us, we've mentioned he's been working on a book. Well, that book has just been published. It's called Twilight of Empire, Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc. It includes stories he wrote for The Atlantic and The New Yorker. Cullen is also a former Moscow bureau chief for Newsweek. Right after the coup, Cullen returned to Russia to update an article he was writing for The New Yorker on the Soviet military. He found that some of his military sources had opposed the coup, others supported it.
One of them was Marshal Sergei Akhromeyev, the former chief of the Soviet General Staff, who had in recent years become President Gorbachev's military advisor. And I found out that he had, in fact, played a significant role in planning and trying to enforce the coup. And when it failed, he hung himself, as you may know. And a few days after his funeral, his grave was robbed, and somebody stole his marshal's jacket, which I gather will bring a fair amount of rubles in the black market. Some of the other sources that I had spoken to in June turned out to be people who were actively involved in the resistance to the coup and who were picking up intelligence from various people who called them anonymously, telling them what the KGB was going to do and what paratroops were going to do and so forth, and whose activities were very helpful in suppressing the coup.
What were you able to find out about why Akhromeyev, Gorbachev's military advisor, why he supported the coup?
Well, there are two explanations that I can give you. In the first place, he made no secret of the fact that he was unhappy with the way that politics were going in the Soviet Union, that what he thought perestroika would be had not turned out to be the case. He had expected a more efficient Soviet Union, but one that looked similar to the one that he had grown up in. And he saw instead a nation teetering on the brink of disintegration, and he saw, I think, the work of his lifetime disintegrating before his eyes. So in that respect, he felt that if he allowed, or if the conspirators allowed things to continue, they would reach a point of no return, and everything that they had built up over their lives would be lost. That's the generous evaluation of the motivation of the conspirators. I think, though, that the most significant impression that I took away from my interview with Akhromeyev in June was how dishonest he was. In response to almost any difficult question that I posed to him, he just blatantly lied. For example, he told me at the beginning of our interview that he participated in all of Gorbachev's military decisions as his military advisor. But when I asked him some questions about the aborted coup d'etat in Vilnius in January and the army's role in it and his role in it, he told me that he knew nothing about it beyond what he saw in the newspapers and that he was not involved in any planning or any execution of that plot at all. So I think the man was dishonest in a way that all of the conspirators were dishonest. They had grown up in a system where inconvenient realities could be manipulated away, or so it seemed to them, that you could always create a myth or tear a page out of a history book or put a new article in Pravda and do away with inconvenient reality. So in the end, I have the sense that they were out of touch with reality, that while it was apparent to me and to a lot of people that I spoke with in June that the army was in no position to support a coup, that it wouldn't fire to support hardline leaders, the conspirators didn't understand that. And that probably, more than anything else, was the cause of their downfall.
Doesn't it seem interesting to you that you could get a sense that Gorbachev's military advisor, Akhramayev, was dishonest, but Gorbachev probably didn't get that if you kept him as his military advisor?
It's very difficult for me to understand why Gorbachev kept the people around him who turned against him in the coup, and nearly all of his closest advisors, in fact, did turn against him. Not only were there the active conspirators, but there are records from meetings of the Council of Ministers during the first day or two of the coup in which no one spoke up in Gorbachev's behalf, even though they all owed their jobs to him. So I think Gorbachev either is a poor judge of character, which is possible, or he felt that he had to keep those people in their positions to continue to play the political game, that he sensed that he was not strong enough to fire them and get away with it. I suspect the latter is the case, that he is not so silly that he wouldn't know, especially after June when they attempted to strip some of his powers in the Supreme Soviet, that people like Kruchkov and Yazov and Pugo wished him no good. But I think that he felt simply that if he were to try to fire them, that he would probably face a coup and therefore chose not to try it.
What are some of the things you were able to find out about regarding how some of the people in the military resisted the coup?
Obviously, there's a certain self-serving character to the accounts that people gave me after the coup, and everybody mm-hmm. who talked to me, with a few exceptions, tried to show themselves as resisting from the initial moments of the coup and being significant in the suppression of the coup. But I think that what had happened over a period of a dozen or so years was a gradual erosion of the once firm loyalty of the military to the Communist Party.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Robert Cullen, and he writes for The New Yorker magazine and The Atlantic, and a collection of his pieces has just been published. It's called Twilight of Empire Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Robert Cullen is my guest, and he recently returned from the Soviet Union, where he has been researching a story that he's completing for The New Yorker magazine on the Soviet military. Were you able to find out about any specific orders that were disobeyed within the military?
Oh, there were a number of them. The top brass, I think, understood fairly early on that the average soldiers in the average army units were not going to be reliable tools in this attempt. They either wouldn't open fire or they didn't have the discipline to carry out operational orders in a difficult urban situation like the one that the conspirators confronted around the Russian White House. So they tried to get special units from the KGB. There's a KGB unit called the Alpha Group, about 200 anti-terrorist commandos, specially trained for urban operations. And there are three KGB paratroop divisions, which are not quite so elite, but which have had some training in urban warfare, because that's one of the scenarios that paratroopers are supposed to be able to handle. And the entire thrust of the conspirators' military effort after the first few hours of the coup, when they failed to arrest Yeltsin, was to start an operation in which the Alpha Group, backed up by some paratroopers, landing in helicopters on the roof of the building, and the building has some very wide roofs, would take over without having to kill all of the crowds that were assembled outside of it. And this is where it gets a little murky. There are a variety of officers from the Alpha Group who are now coming out and giving interviews and so forth, saying that they were the ones who personally resisted those orders and who therefore deserve the credit for the failure of the coup. It's also clear that Colonel Salko got on the phone to his friends in the helicopter divisions, and the helicopter pilots, when the time came to mount this operation, took off and then landed again and said the fog was too heavy and they couldn't fly. General Pavel Grachov, who is the commanding general in charge of the paratroops, simply refused orders to use army paratroops in the operation. And General Yevgeny Shaposhnikov, who has now become the Minister of Defense, didn't allow the Air Force to be used in the operation. So the conspirators were not quite as stupid as they were portrayed to be, I think, by people who thought they didn't understand how to stage a coup. They understood how to stage a coup, and they gave some of the appropriate orders. The orders simply weren't carried out.
Does your research into the military support the idea that the failure of the coup had more to do with opposition from within institutions like the military, more to do with that than it had to do with popular opposition, you know, the crowds in the streets?
Popular opposition was important. Certainly, had there been no crowds around the building, it would have been possible to arrest Yeltsin and his people a lot more easily. The presence of crowds and barricades and so forth obviously wouldn't have stopped a determined military operation, but it would have required the shedding of a lot of blood on worldwide television, and that was a factor. But I think that if the army had obeyed the commands of the conspirators, the coup would have succeeded to the extent that it would have managed to arrest Yeltsin and so forth. But the army didn't obey those orders.
I want to read you a statement that you wrote in your book before the coup. You wrote, in the long run, the Russians can hope to salvage a part of the old empire only by first showing a genuine willingness to let it fall apart. Well, now that it's fallen apart, let me ask you to update that statement.
Well, I think that, in fact, some of the obituaries for the Soviet Union are premature, that the coup forced the Soviets, the Russians, into the position which you just cited. That is, a position where they allowed a genuine choice to be made by the republics. And that, I think, will give them at least an outside chance of preserving the Soviet Union in a fashion not the same as it has been, but not all that different either. Clearly, the Baltic republics and probably a few other small republics have gone and will never get into any kind of political alignment with the Soviet Union again, unless they're forced into it by circumstances that we can't at this time foresee. But if Russia, the Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus, and some of the Central Asian republics can voluntarily form a new kind of union, then 95% of the territory and population and wealth of the Soviet Union will be preserved. And I think there's a chance that that will happen precisely because the Russians, after the coup, were in no position to sustain the union by force and allowed the republics to make a free choice. It'll be interesting to see in the next month or two what the Ukraine does. And I think you will see all of the republics adopt declarations of independence. Nearly all of them have. They may well join the United Nations. But I think that there are pressures once they are presented with a free choice, which will cause them to retain membership in some kind of a union. They're going to be under intense pressure from Western banks and government financial institutions to retain some kind of central economic structure. And they're going to be under pressure from Western governments to retain some kind of central military structure. And if they can do that and then enter into a period where they develop some trust and the people in the various republics become persuaded that the Russians are not intent on swallowing them up, then I think that gradually, like the European community, they may start to draw closer together again.
Would you want to be a reporter based in the Soviet Union now?
No. When I was a journalist in Moscow in the early 80s, I can tell you that there was a Thursday night poker game, which was a long-standing tradition among the foreign correspondents, particularly the Americans. In fact, you can read references to it in the memoirs of diplomats like Llewellyn Thompson, who served there in the 50s. And I think in 3 years in Moscow, I maybe missed 3 or 4 Thursday night poker games. When I got back there last time, I happened to ask somebody if they still played a poker game. And he said not only did they no longer have a poker game, they didn't even know what had happened to the table where all the correspondents had little plaques screwed into it with their names on it and their terms in Moscow. And so the people that work there now, I think, have a much more difficult existence than the correspondents who worked there in the days when very little news came out except in Pravda and on Vremya. And consequently, life in a certain way was a lot easier.
So you mean there's no poker game because there's too much news to cover?
That's right. They can't take the time. I would not want to work in a city where I couldn't play poker.
I don't play poker myself, but I can understand the attitude. I want to thank you very much for talking with us again about the Soviet Union.
You're welcome. It's always a pleasure, Terry.
And my guest has been Robert Cullen, and he writes for The New Yorker magazine and The Atlantic. And his new book has just been published. It's called Twilight of Empire, Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc. And you could look for his next article in The New Yorker magazine sometime in the near future. And that article will be on the army in the Soviet Union. This is Fresh Air. On this last day of Robert Gates' testimony at his own confirmation hearings, let's check in with Linda Wertheimer and see how All Things Considered is covering the story. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Terry. The president's nominee to direct the CIA admitted today that mistakes were made during the Reagan years, and President Bush came out today with a very strong defense of his nominee. So now we'll see what happens. The Iraqis appear to have been somewhat farther along in their production of nuclear weapons than the world had believed. We'll have a story on that. We'll cover the election in Memphis, where a black man has been elected mayor. And take a look at television and the 50s. We seem to be going back, Terry.
Oh, thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday, two TV networks use history as the inspiration for their prime time presentations. PBS launches the first 2 hours of its 7-hour documentary series, Columbus and the Age of Discovery, while ABC becomes the first network to do a docudrama about the Gulf War with its telemovie Heroes of the Persian Gulf. TV critic David Bianculli has these reviews.
In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. It's a rhyme every schoolchild knows. But why did it have to be Christopher Columbus who sailed in 1492? Why not some other man from some other place at some other time?
That's Mauricio Obregón, the Colombian author and explorer, at the start of this long but not epic Columbus series. PBS has high hopes for this show and wants it to be this year's equivalent of the massively successful Civil War series. But Columbus is no Civil War, and Mauricio Obregón is no Shelby Foote. Look, he couldn't even get that poem right. It's not in 1492 Columbus sailed the ocean blue. It's 1492. Without the 100 and, the line doesn't have the proper rhythm, which, come to think of it, is the problem with all 7 hours of this Columbus series. No poetry and no rhythm. Don't get me wrong. You'll learn a lot about Columbus, especially a lot of conjecture. Historians are still arguing about what Columbus looked like, what his motives were, the exact path of his voyages, and even where the Santa Maria sank. But you'll also spend way too much time on land, watching filler footage of parades and modern skylines and open-air shops and stuff. 7 countries threw money into this international Columbus co-production, and all of them seem to want equal time. The series doesn't even set sail, literally, until the 3rd hour, when it finally begins to retrace Columbus's voyage. There's even a man-on-the-street interview segment in Italy, asking elderly citizens of Genoa what they think of Columbus. Come on, folks, this is supposed to make us think of the land of Monte Cristo, not the lunacy of Monty Python. Usually, Genoa is associated with salami, but in Columbus in the Age of Discovery, it's pure baloney. Which segues right into Heroes of the Desert Storm, a TV movie introduced by President Bush.
Americans have always known that what counts is not what we have, but what we are. We realize that as a nation, there are causes worth fighting for, even causes worth dying for. So for over 200 years, Americans have stepped forward to defend the principles we hold dear, principles like freedom, democracy, and justice.
Heroes of the Desert Storm was made with full cooperation of the Pentagon and even uses some of its war footage, Apache helicopters, and military bases in the film. Little-known actors play the roles of real-life helicopter pilots, Patriot missile operators, Marine volunteers, captured airmen, and other Gulf War participants. Their recreated scenes are mixed with actual news and military footage. You even see the same smart bomb airstrikes as in the real war, only this time with music.
As the coalition advance becomes a total rout of the Iraqis, there appears to be a complete breakdown in Iraqi discipline and military. According to forward elements of the coalition forces already in Kuwait City, the fleeing Iraqis have commandeered anything with wheels, stuffed them with whatever they could take, and headed north toward home.
Returning pilots describe...
It's awful. The wartime scenes with music look like a recruiting film, and even more like a video game than the real war did. And because they're intercut with badly staged scenes, the actual images from the war, like POW Jeffrey Zahn staring into a TV camera, are drained of their drama and impact. And the script is so clunky and the characters so cartoonish that Heroes of the Desert Storm is like a Gulf War version of the Poseidon Adventure. Give ABC News credit for having nothing to do with this, but give ABC Entertainment the blame. The network didn't just buy this, they made it using their own in-house production company. With Columbus, at least, the producers made room for all sorts of different viewpoints. Heroes of the Desert Storm is one-sided, and it's one sorry docudrama.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. If you want to pass on your comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Bob Alls, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester, and it's performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The financial scandals and excesses of the past decade have been interpreted by many experts as a sign that regulatory agencies haven't been doing their jobs. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Vise about the Securities and Exchange Commission and its regulation of Wall Street. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.